Welcome to the O'Reilly Data Show. I'm your host, Ben Lorica. Today, I'll be talking to my good friend, DJ Patil. DJ and Hiller Mason just released an ebook with us called Data Driven, Creating a Data Culture. DJ and I will talk about data science, ethics, and a lot more topics. Enjoy the show. Our guest today is DJ Patil. Many of you guys probably have heard of him. Obviously, he's probably, if not the, among the most famous data scientists out there. Many of you know him from LinkedIn, but he's also built a team in a bunch of other places, most recently at RelateIQ. Speaking of which, DJ, I always think of you as one of the best speakers on the topic of building data teams and data products. But I know that you're a mathematician originally, and obviously mathematicians tend to work alone. So how did you become such a team player?
So first, Ben, I think of well-known guys, you're way up there too, because everyone reads what you say and goes to you as well. So you can't give, I'm not going to let you give me the spotlight without dragging you into it too. You know, I think the funny part there is like, I think our first conversation was actually not about data, but more about math.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, you come from that background too. And I think the thing that is there for all of us is the enrichment that happens and how much more you can do when you're part of a team. And I think even many of those who are in math and these other areas are realizing that even those areas are team sports too, and that by working together as a collaborative group, you just can accomplish so much more. And I was super fortunate as an academic that I always worked on projects where they were very team-oriented and very interdisciplinary, very multidisciplinary. And in fact, I think those of us that come from those areas and really what became the data science area were people who were, by definition, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, and had the ability to draw on other people's strengths to solve a problem that otherwise one person just couldn't solve on their own.
So were you also basically, at that point, you were probably much more along the scientific track, right? So, and, you know, the stereotype is there's not a lot of soft skills for people in that domain. But were you, I've always been struck by how articulate you are in terms of explaining things to the general public. Was that always something you were comfortable with?
Well, in fact, what was true for my research group, so the research group I trained with, which was really run by Jim York and Ed Ott, for those that are familiar with the field of chaos theory, you know, those are the guys who created the field of chaos theory. And one of the things that was really required of you as a grad student was the emphasis on communication. And before you presented to the senior researchers on the team, the professors, you had to present to the other grad students. And their job...
You mean like as a dry run?
Oh, yeah. You had to do several dry runs. And they shredded you. Wow. I mean, they trashed you. Everything from the font size of your graph to the labels to the colors... Is it legible? Can we understand you? I mean, we shredded ourselves because by the time you got to the professor, if you didn't have your stuff together and weren't already good, you were going to get even more, like the shredding was going to be brutal. And it was public with all the other grad students. So it was something that was heavily emphasized. And the view was real communication doesn't happen through papers. Papers are where you document and make sure all the stuff, the details, and you go through all this up, the really making sure everything is right. But the real place communication happens is through either teaching or presentations. And you have to create a narrative and a way of engaging people to help them really take that path of very complex ideas. And if you don't, you've lost. And I think the thing with data science, and you know this too, I think, communicating with all these kind of diverse audiences is the onus isn't on those that are running the company to understand data. It's our job to bridge the gap and help them understand the capacity, the potential, and all the amazing things that can happen when we have the opportunity to do what we do. And communication is a central component of that. And when we're building the teams and we're interviewing people and all those things, we are looking for that characteristic. We want people who are phenomenal communicators. And I think you see it. You look at people like Pete Scumarach or Joe Adler or Monica Rigatti, Daniel Tunkelin, Jonathan Goldman. All of these people I consider phenomenal communicators. And without them, we would I don't think data science would really merge. And that's true of not just people who we've been fortunate enough to work with each other, collaborate with, but you take yourself, your Roger, Roger Margolis, or Hammerbacher, or Hillary Mason. All these people are phenomenal at communicating tough, hard ideas in a way that doesn't feel either overbearing, somebody looking down at you. It's done in a way that's extremely engaging and helpful. And I think that is an incredibly important thing that all data scientists must have. It's not a nice to have, must have.
Yeah, speaking of which, actually, you and Hillary just released a fantastic new short ebook on basically building a data-driven culture. And you guys really talk about how people are so important in companies who want to be known as data-driven companies, right? So I guess along those lines, what are the key ingredients of a data scientist when you were at LinkedIn or in the other places you went that you look for besides technical skills? I guess you talked about communication skills, but walk me through kind of your recruiting thought process when you look at and engage someone.
Yeah, so one of the things that Hillary and I tried to do when we started collaborating this, and Mike Lukides deserves a ton of credit here too, because this wouldn't have happened without Mike, is this question of what is a data scientist? You know, and it kind of comes back to that initial question that we faced both at Hammer at Facebook and when we were working on it at LinkedIn, is what do we call ourselves? What do we do these things? And, you know, I think that, and for those that don't know the story, that the part really is that when we're sitting down and trying to figure out what the right title is, I think it was Jeff who actually really first proposed it after we kind of looked at all these other titles. But we were the ones who really had the opportunity because we're LinkedIn. So we A-B tested all the job postings. And Monica actually gave a talk about this. Monica Rigatti gave a talk about this at one of the Strata Confs, I think. And it was like the job description. We just subbed out, you know, are you an analyst or research scientist, engineer? And we looked at the people who responded the best to those roles. And that's really the one that people gravitated to, was that generic term of data scientist. If you look at the skill sets that they had, you know, people came from all sorts of odd walks of life. And one of the things that we tried to do in here was really characterize, well, what is a data scientist from our mind, in our opinion? And we put a Venn diagram in there. And one of the things I think which is really telling about it is like, okay, you got to have math, stats, you got to code, you got to have nerdism. But equally important is that other part of the Venn diagram of communication. And to me, the data scientist, the reason data scientist as a term has worked well is it's a much more of a big tent model, and lots of people can fit in there. Are you much more of a person who looks at stats? Great. Are you a person who builds product? Great. Are you a person who does much more engineering? Great. It's okay to be ambiguous. I don't think we need to have the specifics. Just in the same way you have front-end engineers and back-end engineers and systems engineers.
I'm actually also... I also love people who come from social sciences, frankly.
Yeah. Some of the best ones right now are coming out of social sciences. And there's so many, I mean, Chris Albin, Drew Conway, These guys are all out of the social sciences. And I think one of the areas that we have not tapped into where I think we're going to see a lot more crossover is bioinformatics.
Right.
And both directions, by the way.
Which begs the question, actually, DJ. Obviously, the practicing data scientists that you've named and respect all come from traditional disciplines, right? But now there's this flowering of data science programs, certificates, masters. And frankly, I don't know what to make of it because I guess at the risk of dating myself, back in the day when I got out of grad school, the option for people like us was Wall Street, right? So then it became like a flowering of masters in financial engineering and things like that. And now I'm seeing a flowering of data science master's program. And I'm not saying that that's bad or anything, but what's happened to the masters in financial engineering? I guess there was that meltdown a few years ago.
Well, we should call a spade, right? Yeah, which is, well, you and I both saw that masters of financial engineering, the MIS degree, the information sciences degree.
Right.
And many of these became effectively in the perception of people's minds at this stage as second-rate degrees to computer science or to math or to physics.
Right.
And my fear is that data science degrees become that.
Right.
And that would suck.
Right. Right.
That would be terrible. Now, I think there is a very reasonable role to say, hey, that data science can bloom into something much more organic. And bioinformatics or biophysics are good examples of areas that have done that.
Right.
What is a right curriculum and the right things that are in there? My fear right now is that it's overly geared towards consumer internet products,
right,
versus all the great things that can be done in social sciences, in government, enterprise technology, medicine, health, hospital. You know, all these areas I think is wide open, and it's unclear in early places on how to do that.
Or I guess even the way you described the people that you have come to work with and respect, in a sense, they come from traditional disciplines, and then they worked in industry, and industry became their finishing school, and they became data scientists in industry.
So, that's right. Yeah. I think, if anything, all of us, that was true.
Right.
You know, Jonathan Goldman was a physicist and then was a consultant for a little while. But I think we all really, myself included, grew up in industry, and we grew up together. And I say that as not just a LinkedIn team. I think all of us, that were kind of trying to figure out, like, hey, don't we have a home looking at these things and working on these problems?
You know, I'm going to do a little segue here. The other thing,
sure,
I love to hear your thoughts on, because I think, again, you're one of the key proponents and explainers of this topic, is the notion of data products. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you, of all the people I've come across, you're the person who really is a great evangelist around this term. But it seems like it's still a term that's largely a Bay Area concept. Am I correct, or are you hearing this in other places?
I think it's starting to emerge a little bit more, but I think it's still very Silicon Valley centric. But I think that the thing that we're starting to see is, When people say a data product, they're no longer restricted in thinking of it just as like it can be a whole company. And I think people are realizing, GE just announced that they're...
Or it could be even, DJ, it can even be a government.
Absolutely. Anything, right? I think it absolutely can be the government. And I think that we're going to see a lot more of that. I mean, the president signed the executive order that says, hey, everything's got to be machine readable. And we're starting to see the advantage. And one of the things, like, for example, I think is going to be one of the big things that we're going to see over the next decade is, how do we start really unlocking the value proposition from the genome? The genome to the phenome, the phenotyping to the medical records and the outcomes of all these things. And how does that all start to come together? That's a data problem at the end of the day. And one of the things that we'll start realizing is that part of this is a numbers game. Like, the more people that that we have access to for their genome, what are the great things we might be able to unlock in terms of new pharmaceuticals, new treatments, and understanding who we are.
So let's go back to your what you and Hillary just published. So very briefly, how would you describe a data-driven organization? In particular, what do these organizations do well?
Yeah, so what these organizations really do well is they take in data, they know how to process data internally, externally, they use data sets from all sorts of places, but they don't just take the data and collect it. They utilize that data to make increasingly better decisions and course correct. So they're able to take that data and then navigate the build things with the data and to navigate the complexity of their landscape. And basically, how do you compete? So the part of that
is... It's not just, in other words, it's not just building data products. It could be simple things like good dashboards.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that's one of the ones which we really talk about is I think most people who look at a dashboard, it's painful. They suck. Yeah, I mean, they're just like horrible. You're just like, oh my God, who designed this? This is like it's you know, the worst one is the one where they have a map of the United States and then it's supposed to change a color. It's like Rhode Island is going to change a color and you're going to notice compared to Texas. Right. Or the infamous pie chart that changes 1% and you're like, I don't understand what the hell this is. Yeah. And, you know, and it gets worse. Like they make it, let's make the pie chart 3D and that'll make sense. Right. It's, and those are products. Those are data products in themselves. And how do you get people to, well, maybe here's the right way to say it. One of the big mistakes that I see in data organizations is that the data scientists and other people as well who want to be data driven use data as a political weapon. They say, I have data, therefore I'm going to use the data to beat you down. And so data becomes this thing that's not empowering, but as a weapon.
In that sense, they may even start hoarding data.
Absolutely. Oh, all the time. So you see this in the larger company. Somebody says, hey, can I get access to your data? They're like, no way. No. Because you're going to beat me over the head with my own data. I won't allow it. And so increasingly fragments things. But if you have an environment which is truly data-driven, where people are willing to come to the table and have a conversation about the data, to be intellectually honest and say, hey, my graph goes up, your graph goes down. Let's try to understand why that is. And then we go, oh, wait, we're asking two slightly different questions. But wow, we became away from this that much smarter. That's better for everyone. Everyone will get better out of that thing. It also allows you to lead, and one of the things we call the data scientific method, which is really the scientific method, is how do you create a hypothesis-driven model for iteration? Because you say, we have a strategy. But then most times people don't have a way of testing that strategy. They have no way of saying, well, maybe we should try this lightweight way of seeing first if this is a good strategy or not. And what are we going to do if that strategy is right? What are we going to do if that strategy is wrong? And that whole formulation to scientists, right, it's sort of, it's duh. It's super obvious. But to many in the industry, it's and many other people, we've somehow through our educational process, that only carries up to sixth grade and then they forget it. And so part of being data-driven is bringing back the scientific method, creating hypothesis-driven frameworks, testing, iteration, designing, debating, all the things that we'd expect from an intellectually honest organization.
So I think you go out there a lot, you give talks, you meet a lot of people. You know, it's being data-driven, it probably gets harder as you get bigger, right?
Yeah.
As a company. So,
yeah.
So did you and Hillary interview some of the larger companies and figure mm-hmm. out the ones that are data-driven, what's their secret?
Well, that's was the genesis of this was, Hillary and I had totally independently spent, some time with different kinds of companies where we'd been asked to come in and talk to them, and just were learning, just it was just kind of fun to see what was there. And then we kind of, when we were talking about it, we were faced with this, man, what is kind of the common thing that people are doing well? What are the things that people aren't doing well? What would we like to share? So we had already effectively done the research without really trying. And so this is the culmination of the result of what we saw, what these people had done. One of the interesting things is companies get larger is how important it is that the leader is data driven. And you can see this, you know, LinkedIn is exceptionally data driven and just unbelievable how so. Reid Hoffman, Bezos, you get to, you know, at the larger side, Jeff Immelt, and all the stuff that they've done at GE to even the president of the United States, who's driving so much on data and trying to understand things. It really starts at the top.
Actually, speaking of the top, reading your report reminded me of the emerging new title called Chief Data Officer, right? So, and yep. you guys have this funny thing where I think the first ever Chief Data Officer was Spock on Star Trek.
Yes.
But is this just another one of these C-level positions that may be not having much impact? So what's your take on the Chief Data Officer?
Yeah, so I think there's a new set of roles emerging as things are changing. I think the CIO, the Chief Information Officer of 10 or 15 years ago, was really much more like the Chief Data Officer. They were really responsible for the information. The CIO nowadays is much more about these questions of bring your device to work, security, the owning the IT systems. And the CTO tends to be much more on the product side. So given that we have to have all these questions of the IT budget and all these other things, the roles overlap. The CTO, the CIO, the Chief Data Officer, the Chief Data Scientist, these all overlap. The question of...
Well, I guess let's take a step back. Roughly speaking, yeah. What does the Chief Data Officer do?
So the Chief Data Officer is the person who is responsible for good stewardship of the data. They are responsible for compliance with the data. And they are the people who have the mandate to make sure that the company has access to the data and in a great, easy way and is using the data. It helps frame those conversations where data can be more effectively used. So they run the metrics meetings. They help make sure the dashboards are not in just good shape. They're in great shape. They're the guys who, when you have a problem, you want to make sure like that guy is in the room or someone on that team is in the room because they're that Spock. They're the Spock on the bridge.
Does this track with, because I'm noticing there's a lot of chief data officers in the public sector. Is your description, does it track with what CDOs in the public sector do?
Yeah, I think I think it's still very evolving, but I would say it's starting to align around that. And there's a question of separate of role and title and where you sit. Like these all could sit under the CIO. They could all sit under the CTO. They could all sit under the CDO. I think it's we should separate roles from hierarchy, because a hierarchy is better determined by what's right for each group. But we have seen that New York has their version of a chief analytics officer. LA has a chief data officer. The U.S. Department of Commerce is looking for their chief data officer. The NSA, CIA have one. You go through the list. You just do a quick LinkedIn search and you go, whoa, holy cow. There's a lot of people who now have this role. And I don't think it's just because people want to create some artificial sexy role. They're getting real value out of these people. And some of the people who have taken these roles, these are phenomenal people. These are really, really exceptional people.
By the way, one the most surprising topic, I have to say, in the new piece that you and Hillary did is meetings. I would never mm-hmm. have expected that you guys would spend time talking about meetings. But when I read it, it all makes sense. But so how did you arrive at being so interested in how meetings work? Is it because you sit in so many meetings?
It is. It's, if you think about that pain point of where you roll your eyes the most, and maybe the right way to ask it is, which meetings in the day or things or activities in your day give you energy? Which ones take away energy from you? And so often it's the meetings that take away energy. It's those kind of meetings where you go in and go, oh my God, where's the data? Or it's just painful. And that's why we want to address it head on, because there's a lot of people who are out there who need something to say, hey, how do we have a conversation about this, about what is a good meeting? What would be a good data meeting? And when we brought this up with companies, when they've talked about it, this is one of the areas we get the most questions on.
Really?
In a couple of different ways. One way is people ask a lot of questions about, hey, can you show me a good dashboard? Which is very tough because you can't obviously show easily dashboards. But everything from, can you show me the dashboard to, well, can you walk me through what a really great metrics meeting or a good meeting with data looks like? Because people don't have a prototype for it.
Actually, before we close, I'd like to go back to roles. And so we talked about data scientists, we talked about CDOs, but we forgot the rock stars that you and I love, the data engineers, right?
So right.
As you probably know, you guys at LinkedIn had some of the best data engineers out there. But is that a term that you're also seeing?
Yes. Yeah. So we are, and I think there's two different new things. And in one of the mini books, I used to call it data services. And I think that's not enough of a respectful term. It should be data operations. And the guys who actually are responsible for, just like you would think about normal operations teams,
right,
of keeping systems up, keeping things running, rack and stack, all the way through. Without those guys, that's like the foundation. Those guys, you're dead.
Who maintain your data flows and
build your
data stack.
Totally. Like, those guys do not get enough credit. Great data ops guys don't get enough credit. And services makes them seem like they are some sort of lackeys, which they are not. They can hold their own with the best of them.
Yeah, and obviously the folks that can do all of that can get you started.
In
analytics even, right?
So that's right. They can do it all.
They can run a little bit of your machine learning as well.
Yep. They can. They're there. And then on top of that, you need to have guys and gals. Gender doesn't matter to me. You've got to have guys who are really great engineers. Who are coming up with the next, or who are able to implement or come up with the next Cassandra, Voldemort. You name it. These type of things. Without these new systems, you're also dead in the water. And the implementation of these things, just take something like Storm and Kafka and binding that together and how much pain there is in trying to do that. And you realize, man, the engineering and talent that's required to get this stuff up and going, non-trivial. And even programs like Data Insight Fellows are now starting to train data, train people for data engineering because there's so much specialization. And something that you've been around a bunch is even Spark and these types of things. These are still early stuff, but they require special expertise, just like database and systems guys required a specialty. These guys are specializations in their own right.
There's also, in terms of dashboards, obviously, people are aware of and value designers, right? So great visualization designers. But, I'm also starting to come across people who actually work with data people but come from a product design background, right?
So, yeah.
Because the product design people have all these methodologies for building things that I think is worth it for data people to start interacting with people from those areas as well.
So that actually was one of the things people don't realize with having a product team. When you build a product team, you have to have a holistic team. So one of the things that I spent a lot of time on is finding the right type of designers to work with the data scientists and everybody else. Because just there's a different type of thinking that has to happen around these type of products. And everything from, visual to interaction, all of these things, you need a specialization. And there are some, I've been very fortunate to work with some of the guys, who I think are some of the world experts on this, everyone from Mike Alperin, Anita Lilly, there's so many of them, them, like Noah Linsky, all these kind of people. These people aren't just viz people, and they don't just make charts and graphs. They make a product come to life. Otherwise, most data products are just some command line type thing. Right. And the really great data scientists all have tremendous, great design chops as well. They all are hybrids that way.
All right. So I'd like to close actually with something on a more serious note that I'm starting to actually also start paying attention to, and I'm sure you are too, which is the impact of all these things we're building, right? So everyone knows about privacy and all of that stuff, but how about just there's people who are growing anxious about the role that machine learning plays in decision making, right? So the cultural impact of models. Maybe there's price discrimination, based on where you live. So, are you finding that other data scientists or even other companies are starting to think about these things?
Yes, and I think the thing that I'm happy about is many of those in the data science communities are the first to raise their hands about calling this as an important item. And I think what we're going to start seeing is a critical component of the chief data officer is data ethics. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
And the number of times where I've worked with data and people where people are like, well, what is the implication of us doing this? An implication isn't just it's a lot of times it's perception. How is this going to make someone feel? Is it going to be good? Is it going to be bad? What is the long-term aspects that we have to think through in putting this out there?
Even think about it from an empathetic point of view, right?
That's right.
How would I feel if
this
were done to me, right? So,
yeah. That's right. And the there's a whole set of other issues, I think, which are out there, which are going to be public debate, which is, should we be allowing these things to happen? And, I think a lot of times people are most often concerned about the consumer internet companies. I think people often forget about all these data brokers and these other people who have been collecting this stuff, and the data is not even transparent to us. Right. And that's not, I'm not trying to give us a blank, sort of redirect the conversation away from Silicon Valley. It's more so of saying that we need to have a conversation where we talk about where our data is, how do we have control of it? And even in the bio space, because if you give up your data and your wife gives up her data, well, your kids have opted into their data. Right. And so what does that mean? And these are things that I think are privacy and ethics and all of the things around this. We're going to see much more of this. Like, for example, one of the ones that was recently written about and I thought was a thought experiment that I've been using for quite some time, which is the classic one, which says you're on a train track and you're at a switch and there's five people on one track and there's one person on the other track. Train's coming and you have to pick which way the train's going to go. Do you kill the five or do you kill the one?
Right.
The math is obvious. You pick the one. But now what happens if you're designing a self-driving car and you have to decide, you're careening towards five people, you're in the car, do I drive the car off a cliff and kill you as a consequence, or do I put the car into the five people? Who's my responsibility to?
Right.
And it seems like a trivial thing, but what happens when you think about it in terms of somebody like a drone or something else that is trying to make a mathematical assessment.
Automated systems, yeah.
Yeah. And this suddenly becomes, we're talking about worlds of probabilities and what is an acceptable probability, an acceptable form of risk. And we have to have a way of having an honest, open intellectually, you know, basically I have to have a conversation about the data and what we think. And that is a societal question as much as it is a question of what is our capabilities and how we should think about this for data. And all these data programs, I think one of the most important things that everyone should be taking is a class on ethics. Everyone that works in a scientific area, including data scientists, must take at least a class in ethics.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that's something actually I don't know if many of these programs are actually doing that.
Yeah, I don't. I was very fortunate. I was very fortunate in my training to be required to go through ethics, an ethics class, and a very traditional style ethics class. And I can tell you, I can't tell you how many times that class has come to aid. And you know, just simple questions, whether it was at LinkedIn, RelayIQ, the government, wherever, they always come to me because that gives me a formal way to think about it and to have a conversation. Because you hold incredible power when you have access to the data, and you have to be able to ask yourself, should we be doing this? Or maybe we should do it. But the question is, how should we go about doing it?
All right. So I think you and I can talk for hours.
Yeah, we can go.
But I think we should keep this short for our listeners. But thank you again. So again, our guest today has been DJ Patil, a long-term friend of O'Reilly. He's written so many things for us, not just blog posts, but now I think this is now your third.
Yeah, this is the third one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So,
and thank you for all the help. This is always fun, Ben.
And he also speaks at our conferences. So thank you again, DJ.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
You can reach DJ through his Twitter handle, @dpatil. Thank you for joining us. If you like the show, you can subscribe through SoundCloud or iTunes and never miss an episode.